Part 1, Florence Duomo Exterior and Facade, Extended Storytelling Draft. Welcome on board with EU Tours. We begin our journey standing in the heart of Florence, in the square known as Piazza del Duomo. Around you rises one of the most extraordinary architectural ensembles in Europe, the Baptistry of San Giovanni, Giotto's slender bell tower, and before us, the vast marble face of the Cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore, the Duomo of Florence. This is the symbol of the city, the emblem of the Florentine Republic, and for centuries the gathering place of faith, power, ritual, and memory. Take a slow look at the exterior. The cathedral dominates the skyline with its massive red-tiled dome, an engineering wonder that still astonishes architects and engineers today. But before we speak of the dome, let us pause on the facade, the great marble screen that greets every visitor. Its white marble comes from Carrara, the same quarries Michelangelo later used for his statues. The green is serpentine from Prato, a nearby Tuscan town. The pinkish-red is from Maremma. Together, they create a polychrome tapestry, a kind of stone embroidery that seems to glow differently in the morning sun, in the midday heat, or at sunset when the facade blushes warm gold. Yet what you see is not medieval. For centuries, Florence's cathedral had no facade at all. The first front was torn down in the late 16th century because the Medici considered it outdated. For more than 300 years, the cathedral's western face stood bare, with rough brick and traces of unfinished decoration exposed to everyone who entered the square. Imagine the embarrassment of a proud city with the greatest dome in the world, but no proper facade to match it. Proposals came and went. Some were too costly, others too extravagant, some too modest. Finally, in the 19th century, as Italy was uniting into a modern nation, Florence decided it was time to complete its great cathedral. A competition was launched, and the architect Emilio de Fabris won with a design in the neo-Gothic style, echoing the forms of Giotto's bell tower and the decorative rhythm of the baptistry. Between 1871 and 1887, his design rose in colored marble, statues, and ornate portals. What had been a long embarrassing absence became a proud face for Florence, now recognized around the world. Step closer to the central portal. Above it you will see a sculpted tympanum with the enthroned Christ and his mother Mary. To the sides, niches with prophets and saints. The large rose window floods the nave with light, and its tracery mimics the celestial harmony that medieval builders believed was encoded in geometry itself. Every statue, every figure, every pattern was designed to speak to the visitor, reminding them of the mysteries of faith and the grandeur of Florence's devotion. Now let your eyes rise higher. The facade culminates in sharp gables and pinnacles, covered with small details. If you had a telescope, you would see faces, scrolls, angels, floral motifs, a universe of stone craftsmanship. 19th-century critics sometimes complained that de Fabris's design was too archaeological, too full of Gothic quotations. But for us today, the facade is a harmonious masterpiece, uniting the square's ensemble in a vision of colored stone. Shift your gaze slightly to the right. Giotto's campanile, the bell tower, rises 84 meters high. Every level is clad in the same marble as the cathedral, with lozenge-shaped reliefs at the base by Andrea Pisano and Luca della Robbia. Each relief tells a story of human endeavor, the arts, sciences, trades, and virtues that make up the fabric of Florentine life. The campanile is a slender exclamation mark beside the dome's mighty curve, and its beauty lies in proportion rather than sheer mass. Turn back to the cathedral. Notice how the body of the church stretches in long horizontal stripes of marble. The eye is carried down the nave toward the great crossing under the dome. This is not accidental. The builders wanted every citizen, every traveler, every pilgrim who stepped into Florence to know at once. Here is the city's heart, here is its temple, here is its pride. The cathedral you see today is the third church built on this site. Beneath our feet lie the ruins of the older Basilica of Santa Reparata, dating back to the early centuries of Christianity in Florence. The decision to build a new, much larger cathedral came in the late 13th century, when Florence was booming with commerce, banking, and artistic innovation. The Republic wanted a building that would eclipse rival cities like Pisa and Siena. In 1296, work began under Arnolfo di Cambio, one of the greatest architects of his generation. His vision was for a colossal Gothic basilica with pointed arches, ribbed vaults, and a crossing so wide that no one knew how it could be roofed. Arnolfo died after only a few years of work, but his foundations had set the path. For the next 150 years, generation after generation of Florentines labored on the project, adjusting designs, enlarging ambitions, debating how to finish the vast central hole that yawned above the crossing. Imagine centuries of scaffolding, workshops, stonecutters, marble transport, guild debates, city council votes. The construction of the Duomo was not a single architect's dream, but a civic marathon that spanned lives. And yet, when the dome was finally completed in the 1430s by Filippo Brunelleschi, it became a wonder that astonished Europe. Travelers compared it to ancient Rome's Pantheon, but higher, bolder, and without visible support. Florence had achieved the impossible. Pause for a moment now and take in the total silhouette. The wide nave, the green and white marble skin, the vertical campanile, and above all the dome, rising like a fiery crown. It is not just an architectural achievement, it is Florence's self-portrait, the city's declaration of its own genius, faith, and endurance. Standing here in Piazza del Duomo, just opposite the cathedral's facade, you see the octagonal building clad in white and green marble. This is the Baptistry of San Giovanni, one of Florence's oldest and most venerated monuments. Long before the Duomo rose in Gothic magnificence, the Baptistry stood here as the city's sacred heart. For centuries, Florentines believed it had been a Roman temple, perhaps dedicated to Mars, converted to Christian use in the early days of the faith. That legend was dear to the city, though modern archaeology shows it was built as a Christian structure between the late 4th and early 5th centuries, then given its octagonal form around the 11th century. Why octagonal? In Christian symbolism, the number 8 represents rebirth, the 8th day after creation, the eternity that follows time. Baptistries across Italy often take this form, but Florence's is among the most magnificent. Here every child of Florence, including Dante Alighieri himself, was baptized. Dante called it, "My beautiful San Giovanni," and remembered its marble font with deep affection in his Divine Comedy. Imagine generations of citizens, nobles, merchants, artisans, even the great artists of the Renaissance, all beginning their lives here with water poured upon their foreheads beneath the baptistry's dome. The exterior, clad in geometric panels of white Carrara marble and dark green Prato marble, became a model for Florentine architecture. Giotto echoed its pattern in his campanile. Arnolfo and later architects echoed it in the cathedral. The baptistry is the seed, the prototype, the elder sibling. Its form is severe yet harmonious, each level marked by arches and blind arcades, culminating in a low pyramidal roof once sheathed in bronze tiles. Now walk closer to the bronze doors, for they are among the greatest treasures of Western art. The south doors, created by Andrea Pisano between 1330 and 1336, depict scenes from the life of John the Baptist, Florence's patron saint. They are cast in bronze, each panel framed like a jewel, each figure delicate and narrative. These doors were revolutionary in their time, a marriage of Gothic elegance with Florentine naturalism. The north doors, a generation later, were made by Lorenzo Ghiberti between 1403 and 1424 after he won a famous competition. When the city announced a contest to design new doors, young artists including Filippo Brunelleschi and Jacopo della Quercia submitted models. Ghiberti's won, and his 20-year labor produced panels filled with grace, harmony, and a new sensitivity to perspective. The north doors depict scenes from the life of Christ, the evangelists, and the church fathers. Yet it is the east doors, again by Ghiberti, that became legendary. Begun in 1425 and completed in 1452, they consist of 10 large panels illustrating Old Testament stories, Adam and Eve, Noah, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, David, and Solomon. Unlike the earlier quatrefoil design, these panels are spacious narrative reliefs, with multiple episodes depicted in a single field, using perspective to create depth. Michelangelo himself gazed upon them and declared, "They are so beautiful they could be the gates of paradise." From that phrase, they have been known ever since as the Porta del Paradiso. Pause to imagine the effect of these gilded panels in the 15th century, sunlight striking gold, stories unfolding in bronze relief, citizens gathering in the piazza to read salvation history in metal. The baptistry's doors became a public Bible, a civic mirror, an open catechism. The very competition that gave Ghiberti his career also propelled Brunelleschi toward his obsession with architecture, setting him on the path that would lead to the dome of the cathedral. In this way, the baptistry's doors are not just works of art, but turning points in the history of Florence and the Renaissance itself. Now, step inside the baptistry in your imagination. The first impression is dazzling. The entire dome and upper walls are covered with golden mosaics. Created between the 13th and 14th centuries, these mosaics were made by artists including Jacopo Toriti, Cimabue, and perhaps even Venetian masters. At the center is Christ in majesty, immense, stern, with arms outstretched. Below him unfolds the Last Judgment, angels, saints, the blessed ascending to paradise, and the damned cast into hell. Look closely and you can find devils roasting sinners in cauldrons, a grotesque demon devouring the lost, while other souls are weighed in scales by the Archangel Michael. These mosaics were terrifying sermons in color and light, designed to impress upon every initiate the reality of sin and salvation. Around the dome are cycles from Genesis, the lives of Joseph, Mary, Christ, and John the Baptist. Imagine a medieval Florentine standing here at baptism, gazing upward to see the entirety of salvation history unfolding in glittering tesserae. The floor beneath is a marble labyrinth of geometric designs, circles, and zodiac symbols, suggesting the order of the cosmos under God's providence. The font, once in the center, was large enough for total immersion of infants, though today only fragments of it remain. Everywhere the baptistry speaks of Florence's pride in its patron saint, John the Baptist. His feast day on June 24th was celebrated with great processions, games, and fireworks. Guilds decorated the city, poets composed verses, and ambassadors marveled at the wealth and devotion of Florence. Even today, on the eve of his feast, the city launches fireworks from Piazzale Michelangelo, lighting up the sky above the very monuments we see. Thus, the baptistry is more than an old building. It is the city's spiritual cradle, its civic temple, the womb from which generations of Florentines emerged into Christian life. Without the baptistry, the cathedral would lack its elder companion. Together they form the dialogue of Florence's identity, one ancient, octagonal, shimmering with mosaic gold, the other vast, Gothic, and crowned with Brunelleschi's dome. They are two faces of a single tradition, the continuity of faith and the evolution of art. As you leave the square and step across the threshold of Santa Maria del Fiore, your senses shift. Outside, the facade dazzled you with marble and detail. Inside, you are met with vastness, height, and solemnity. The Florentines built this interior to be not a glittering jewel box, but a cavernous hall, a monumental stage for ceremonies that were as civic as they were sacred. The city wanted space for 10,000 people to gather. Imagine processions of guild members with banners, magistrates in their robes, and the great families of Florence walking in solemn ranks beneath these vaults. The light is dim, filtered through stained glass and softened by centuries of dust and devotion. The stone piers rise like trees in a forest, supporting pointed arches that draw your eyes upward. The marble floor beneath your feet is a tapestry of geometric patterns, circles, squares, interlaced designs, laid in the 15th and 16th centuries. This floor is not random decoration but a carefully planned surface that mirrors the harmony of the building above. Now turn back for a moment, just inside the doors, and look up. There, above the central entrance, is one of Florence's most unusual treasures, a giant clock painted by Paolo Uccello in 1443. Unlike our clocks, which reset at midnight, this one is set to Italian hours, ending the 24th hour at sunset. A single hand circles its face. The hours are marked around the dial in elegant Gothic numerals, painted in Uccello's precise hand. Its position above the entrance is symbolic. Time itself is under the gaze of God, and every day ends in the setting sun, a reminder of mortality and eternity. Astonishingly, this clock still functions today. Few such medieval timepieces survive, making Florence's an extraordinary witness to the way people once measured their lives. Continue walking slowly down the nave, and glance at the walls high above you. There you will see equestrian figures, not sculpted in marble, but painted in fresco. To one side is Sir John Hawkwood, the English mercenary captain who served Florence in the 14th century. Though he died in 1394, Florence commissioned this painted monument in 1436, entrusting it to Paolo Uccello. Uccello painted Hawkwood astride his horse, rigid and monumental, as if cast in bronze and set on a marble pedestal. The illusion is deliberate. The fresco is flat, but it mimics sculpture, showing off the Florentine mastery of perspective. Directly opposite stands another rider, Niccolò da Tolentino, painted by Andrea del Castagno in 1456. His horse prances forward more energetically, his cloak billowing, the perspective more daring. Together the two riders face one another across the nave, guardians of Florence's military reputation, painted monuments to captains who defended the Republic. These works are as much political statements as artistic experiments, Florence declaring in pigment that it honors those who serve its liberty. As you proceed, lift your gaze to the upper walls where stained glass windows break the stone. Between the 14th and 15th centuries, Florence embarked on the most ambitious stained glass program in Italy, commissioning designs from Donatello, Lorenzo Ghiberti, Paolo Uccello, and Andrea del Castagno. In all, 44 windows fill the cathedral with colored light. Imagine the workshops. The artist sketches the scene, the glassmaker selects colored pieces, cuts them, paints delicate details with enamel, then fires them in the kiln before joining them with lead canes into a panel. When sunlight strikes, the images glow like paintings made of fire. Each window tells a story. Some show prophets and saints, solemn figures watching over the nave. Others narrate the lives of Christ and the Virgin. Above the main entrance is an enormous circular occhio, with the coronation of the Virgin, designed by Ghiberti, its blues and reds shining against the stone. Look toward the drum of the dome, and you will see eight colossal round windows, added in the 1430s and 1440s. These are among the masterpieces of Renaissance stained glass. Donatello himself designed one, showing the coronation of the Virgin. The others include prophets and evangelists, each drawn by a master of early Renaissance art. Together they form a crown of light around the base of the dome, an octagonal halo where heaven meets architecture. Pause and look around. The nave may appear austere compared with some Gothic cathedrals in Northern Europe, but the Florentines preferred clarity, geometry, and space. Decoration is concentrated in specific works of art, the painted riders, the stained glass eyes, the patterned pavement. The rest is left in stone and shadow, heightening the sense of immensity. This is intentional. The cathedral is not a jewel for private meditation, but a stage for the entire city, where liturgy, politics, and public life intersect. Close your eyes for a moment and imagine this space in the 15th century. Torches flicker along the piers. Incense rises in curls toward the vaults. The organ thunders and choirs chant polyphonic motets that echo under the dome. Guild banners hang in procession. Magistrates sit in solemn rows. Outside, the bells toll from Giotto's campanile, calling the entire city to attention. The cathedral was not only a church but also the heartbeat of the Republic. When you open your eyes again, let them follow the marble path forward, into the crossing where Brunelleschi's dome rises above you. There, art, architecture, and faith converge in one of the greatest achievements of human genius. But before we lift our gaze to the dome, let us first understand what the Florentines faced. A colossal octagonal hole in their unfinished church, waiting for a roof that no one knew how to build. As you walk toward the crossing, the immense space opens above you, and your eyes are irresistibly drawn upward. There it is, the Dome of Florence, Brunelleschi's miracle, the largest masonry vault in the world. For centuries it has been the emblem of the city, the crown of Santa Maria del Fiore, and the most daring experiment of the Renaissance. To understand its wonder, imagine the problem Florence faced around the year 1400. The cathedral had been rising for more than a century, but its builders left the crossing open, a yawning octagonal space 50 meters wide. No one knew how to cover it. Traditional Gothic cathedrals used wooden centering, scaffolding built up from the ground to support stones as they were laid, but here the space was too vast. To build centering that high would have required cutting down whole forests and spending fortunes, only to remove it afterward. Engineers looked at the gap and shook their heads. Some even suggested leaving it open to the sky. It was Filippo Brunelleschi, a goldsmith by training and an architect by vocation, who stepped forward with a bold solution. He proposed not one dome but two, an inner and an outer shell, locked together by horizontal chains and vertical ribs. He would build it without full wooden centering, using a method that allowed each course of masonry to support the next as it rose. His design was so revolutionary that many doubted it could succeed. But the Republic, after long debate, entrusted him with the commission. In 1420, work began. Picture the scene. Scaffolds rising from the drum, hoists and cranes creaking as oxen-powered ingenious winches that Brunelleschi himself designed. These machines could lift enormous stones and bricks hundreds of feet into the air, then lower them with equal precision. Visitors came from across Europe to marvel at these contraptions, so advanced that Leonardo da Vinci later studied them. The masonry itself was laid in a special pattern. Instead of straight horizontal courses, Brunelleschi arranged many bricks in a herringbone pattern, tilted and interlocked. These diagonal spines transferred the weight inward, locking the structure against collapse as it rose. Imagine masons climbing higher and higher, laying each brick by hand, their work inching the dome upward in a self-supporting spiral. Slowly, year by year, the two shells grew, with stairways and passageways hidden between them. The inner dome rose steeply, visible from inside the cathedral. The outer dome swelled above it, a protective skin that gave the structure its iconic profile. By 1436, the miracle was complete. The dome was capped with a marble lantern, a tower-like crown at its apex, designed by Brunelleschi himself, though finished after his death. Finally, in 1469, Andrea del Verrocchio placed the gilded copper ball and cross on top, a gleaming beacon visible across Tuscany. From the ground where you stand, the sheer size is staggering. The inner span measures over 45 meters in diameter, larger than any dome since antiquity. The height from the floor to the base of the lantern is nearly 90 meters. And yet it holds, century after century, without collapsing, without major reinforcement. Engineers today still study Brunelleschi's techniques, still debate how he achieved such stability. His dome was not only a masterpiece of construction but also a manifesto. Florence had surpassed the ancients, outshone Rome itself, and proclaimed the genius of its people. But Brunelleschi gave Florence not just a structure, he gave it a sky of fresco. Between 1572 and 1579, Giorgio Vasari and Federico Zuccari painted the vast interior surface with a cycle of the Last Judgment. Imagine the immensity of the task, over 3,600 square meters of plaster, covering the largest dome on Earth. From below, the fresco appears as rings of figures spiraling toward the lantern. Closest to the base, angels blow trumpets to awaken the dead. Above them, the resurrected souls are divided, the blessed drawn upward into heaven, the damned dragged downward into hell. Look carefully, and you will see demons torturing sinners, grotesque devils devouring human figures, while angels wield swords of flame. Higher up are patriarchs, prophets, and apostles, enthroned in glory. At the very center, Christ reigns as judge, his right hand raised in blessing, his left hand casting down the damned. Around him gather the Virgin Mary, saints, and choirs of angels, radiant against a sky of gold. The entire fresco is a cosmic vision, a warning and a promise, a reminder that every Florentine baptized in San Giovanni and every visitor standing here will one day face the same judgment. The effect is overwhelming. The dome becomes a theater of eternity, where architecture and painting merge into one vision. Brunelleschi's ribs and masonry gave Vasari his canvas. Vasari's pigments gave Brunelleschi's geometry a story of salvation. Together, they created one of the most powerful experiences of sacred space in the world. Now imagine March 25, 1436, the Feast of the Annunciation, when Pope Eugene IV consecrated the completed cathedral. The city gathered in jubilation. Choirs sang, trumpets resounded, guild banners filled the nave. A new motet by Guillaume Dufay, Nuper Rosarum Floris, was performed, composed to honor the dedication. Its structure mirrored the proportions of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, linking Florence's new house of God with biblical grandeur. For the citizens, the consecration was not just a religious ceremony. It was the Republic's triumph, proof that their city had achieved what no other could. Stand here today and you can still feel it. The dome is not only bricks and mortar, fresco and gold. It is ambition turned into stone, faith translated into geometry, genius immortalized in silhouette. Every traveler arriving in Florence sees it from miles away, rising above the rooftops like a red sun. Every Florentine child grows up with it as part of their horizon. And every visitor who steps beneath it, as you have, cannot help but look up in wonder. When Brunelleschi designed his dome, he intended it as pure architecture, a triumph of engineering. For decades after its completion, the vast inner shell remained a blank surface of masonry, its reddish bricks curving upward without decoration. Some Florentines wondered if the vault should remain unpainted, a monument to geometry itself. Others dreamed of covering it in gold mosaics, like the baptistry. Still others suggested fresco, that uniquely Italian medium, to turn the dome into a painted heaven. It was not until the late 16th century, more than a century after the dome's completion, that Florence resolved to adorn its interior. By this time, the city had changed. The Republic was gone, the Medici dukes ruled as princes. They wanted the cathedral to reflect not only Florence's glory but also their own authority. Grand Duke Cosimo I Medici and his successors decided that the dome should show the ultimate drama of faith, the Last Judgment, where Christ separates the blessed from the damned. The first commission went to Giorgio Vasari, painter, architect, and historian, author of The Lives of the Artists. Vasari was a favorite of the Medici and had already decorated the Palazzo Vecchio with vast frescoes glorifying Cosimo. He began work in 1572. His design followed the traditional scheme, concentric zones of imagery rising from earth to heaven, like Dante's Divine Comedy translated into paint. At the base, Vasari planned to show the resurrection of the dead and the division of souls. Above them, the seven virtues, the choirs of angels, the patriarchs and prophets, the apostles and evangelists, and at the summit, Christ the Judge enthroned in majesty. Vasari himself supervised the early stages, painting figures on the lower sections. He employed assistants, prepared cartoons, and organized the scaffolding that allowed painters to reach the curve of the dome. Imagine the workers climbing narrow wooden stairways, standing on platforms suspended in midair, the enormous concavity stretching around them like the inside of a tilted bowl. Each surface had to be plastered with fresh lime in small patches, known as giornate, and painted quickly before the plaster dried, for true fresco requires pigments to fuse chemically with the wet surface. Vasari's work was interrupted in 1574 by his death. At that point, only part of the cycle had been sketched and painted. The Medici entrusted the completion to Federico Zuccari, a painter from Urbino who had worked in Rome and had a reputation for bold, dramatic figures. Zuccari took over in 1575, bringing with him a different style, less restrained, more theatrical, filled with muscular bodies and vivid gestures. His figures are larger, more dramatic, painted with strong contrasts of light and dark. Critics at the time and since have noted the difference. Vasari's hand is cooler, more ordered, Zuccari's is hotter, more emotional. Together, over 7 years, they and their teams covered the dome with one of the largest fresco cycles in the world, over 3,600 square meters. The Last Judgment unfolds in a vast panorama. At the lowest level, you see scenes of hell. Grotesque demons tearing at sinners, monstrous beasts devouring the damned, men and women punished for pride, greed, lust, and other sins. Some of these images recall Dante's infernal visions, familiar to every Florentine. Higher up are the zones of the blessed, saints with halos, martyrs holding palm branches, patriarchs with flowing beards, prophets with scrolls, apostles in dignified rows. Angels play trumpets, carry the instruments of the Passion, and guide souls upward. At the very center, around the lantern, Christ appears colossal, enthroned in an oval of glory. His right hand blesses the saved, his left hand condemns the damned. Around him, the Virgin Mary intercedes, John the Baptist pleads for mercy, and choirs of angels surround them. The imagery is both terrifying and consoling. terrifying in its visions of punishment, consoling in its promise of salvation for the faithful. The techniques used to paint such a colossal surface were as daring as the dome itself. Scaffoldings were anchored in the walls and ribs, platforms built high above the cathedral floor. Painters had to work in cramped, dangerous conditions, often lying on their backs or leaning over the curve, pigments dripping down. The curvature of the dome meant that proportions had to be adjusted. Figures near the base are painted larger than those near the top so that, from the ground, they appear balanced. Zucari often sketched with charcoal directly on the fresh plaster, then applied layers of pigment ground in water. Reds and blues were made from expensive minerals like cinnabar and azurite. Ochres provided earth tones, white came from lime itself. Imagine the scene inside the cathedral during these years, the vast nave filled with the smell of wet plaster, the echo of hammering as scaffolds were adjusted, voices of painters shouting instructions across the vault, apprentices grinding colors in mortar and pestle, buckets of water hauled up by rope. Worshippers below would have seen patches of the fresco slowly emerging, new saints appearing day by day, zones of color creeping across the immense surface. Not all Florentines approved. Some critics found Zucari's style too theatrical, too Roman, lacking the Florentine clarity of earlier masters. Others were disturbed by the grotesque demons and exaggerated expressions. Yet the scale and ambition could not be denied. By the early 1580s, the dome's interior was completely transformed, from bare brick to a colossal painted cosmos. Over the centuries, smoke from candles, dust, and time darkened the colors. The figures became dim, the details hard to see. In the 1970s and 1980s, a major restoration cleaned the frescoes, revealing again the brilliance of the pigments and the subtlety of the drawing. Today, standing on the cathedral floor, you can look up and see the Last Judgment almost as Zucari's contemporaries saw it. Vivid, terrifying, magnificent. Together, Vasari and Zucari left a legacy that rivals the Sistine Chapel in scale, though in style it belongs to the Florentine world. Their work made the dome not just a triumph of engineering but also a triumph of art, where stone and paint together proclaim the destiny of humanity. Brunelleschi gave Florence a structure that defied collapse. Vasari and Zucari gave it a vision that defied forgetfulness. Every visitor who looks up is reminded not only of Florence's genius but also of the eternal themes of faith, salvation, and judgment that shaped the Renaissance soul. As your eyes leave the dome and return to the walls and piers of the cathedral, you begin to see how many layers of art history are embedded here. The Duomo was never just architecture. It was also a living gallery where Florence's finest sculptors and painters left their mark. Each monument, each panel, each window tells a story of civic pride and artistic rivalry. The most striking works, already mentioned, are the two equestrian frescoes along the nave. On one wall, Paolo Uccello's monument to Sir John Hawkwood, painted in 1436, demonstrates the Florentine obsession with perspective. Uccello was fascinated by geometry, and here he transformed a flat surface into a convincing illusion of a bronze statue set upon a marble pedestal. Hawkwood himself had been a mercenary leader, an Englishman who fought in Italy for decades. Though his profession was controversial, the Republic honored him with this monument, signaling Florence's gratitude for his service. Uccello, whose name means the bird, was less interested in lifelike detail than in geometry. Note the rigid horse, the angular armor, the almost mathematical precision of the forms. Across from him is Andrea del Castagno's monument to Niccolò da Tolentino, painted in 1456. Castagno approached the challenge differently. His horse prances forward dynamically, the commander's cloak whips behind him, the pedestal projects more boldly into illusionistic space. Castagno, known for his vigorous and sometimes harsh style, gives us a more dramatic, almost aggressive vision of military leadership. Together, these two riders show the artistic rivalry of mid-15th century Florence, Uccello's cool geometry against Castagno's fiery energy. Move toward the north aisle and you will encounter sculptural works that blend Gothic delicacy with Renaissance invention. Along the walls and altars are marble reliefs designed by artists such as Nanni di Banco, Luca della Robbia, and Donatello. Donatello, one of the giants of Florentine sculpture, contributed designs for stained glass windows and reliefs for the cathedral's choir lofts. His famous Cantoria, the singing gallery, originally stood in the Duomo before being moved to the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo. Its marble panels, alive with dancing, singing putti, showed Donatello's genius for transforming marble into joyous motion. Facing it across the nave once stood Luca della Robbia's own Cantoria, with more classical, harmonious figures. These two galleries, though now in the museum, remind us how much of Florence's sculptural energy was poured into the cathedral's interior. Along the choir area, near the high altar, are sculpted reliefs by Baccia Bandinelli, a 16th-century sculptor favored by the Medici. Bandinelli is often remembered as Michelangelo's rival. Here in the cathedral, he designed the marble choir enclosure and statuary that still frame the liturgical center. His style is heavier than that of his Renaissance predecessors, but his work reflects the Medici desire to leave their mark on the city's most sacred space. In the sacristies and chapels you find further contributions. The sacristy doors, bronze masterpieces created by Lorenzo Ghiberti, are decorated with panels of New Testament scenes, intricate and full of detail. Ghiberti, already famous for his baptistry doors, extended his genius here, uniting sculpture and architecture in gleaming bronze. The reliefs combine delicacy with narrative clarity, a hallmark of his style. The walls of the chapels also preserve paintings from the 14th and 15th centuries. Though many altarpieces once here were later moved to museums, the cathedral originally housed works by masters such as Domenico di Michelino. His most famous surviving fresco, painted in 1465, still adorns the inner north wall, Dante and the Divine Comedy. This extraordinary work shows Dante holding his epic poem, with the three realms, Hell, Purgatory, and Paradise, spread behind him. To the right, Florence itself is depicted, crowned by Brunelleschi's dome, though Dante had died before it was built. The fresco is both a celebration of the poet and a proud declaration that Florence claimed him as its own, despite his exile. Look closely and you'll see how Michelino organized the vast allegory. Dante, in red robes, presents the Commedia. To one side, sinners tumble into hell's flames, their punishment arranged in circles as Dante described. To another, the mountain of purgatory rises, with souls climbing toward purification. Above them, the celestial spheres of paradise radiate, culminating in the vision of God. Beside Dante, Florence stands radiant, the cathedral itself visible, as if linking the city with the divine journey. This fresco reminds every visitor that Florence saw itself not only as a city of bankers and merchants but also as the city of poetry and spiritual imagination. Elsewhere, you will notice memorial tablets and sculpted tombs of Florentine bishops and dignitaries. The cathedral, though never as filled with tombs as Santa Croce or Santa Maria Novella, still honors its clerics and benefactors with marble monuments. Sculptors like Tino di Cameno and others of the Trecento left traces of their work here. Each epitaph, each effigy, speaks of the cathedral as both house of God and keeper of memory. Above all, the stained glass remains the most pervasive decoration of the inner walls. Spread across the nave, transepts, and drum of the dome, the 44 windows designed by Donatello, Ghiberti, Uccello, and Costagno transform the cathedral into a lantern of color. Donatello's designs, rare survivals of his hand in this medium, show how even a sculptor of bronze and marble could master the play of light through glass. Ghiberti's panels glow with the elegance that made him famous. Uccello brought his geometric vision even here, with figures drawn in precise outlines. Costagno, with his bold style, gave the prophets and saints a forceful presence. Together, these windows form the most important stained glass program of Renaissance Italy, making the inner walls of the cathedral shimmer with biblical light. When you step back and take in all these layers, Uccello's perspective riders, Costagno's fierce horsemen, Dante's fresco by Domenico di Michelino, the choir works of Donatello and della Robbia, the bronze reliefs of Ghiberti, the choir enclosure of Bandinelli, the stained glass cycle, you realize that the Duomo is not just Brunelleschi's dome. It is also a repository of Florentine art from Gothic through Renaissance to Mannerism. Every generation of artists was called to leave its mark here, and each did so in its own style, from the cool Gothic lines of the early sculptors to the exuberant drama of Zuccari's Last Judgment. The cathedral's interior is therefore a palimpsest, a layered manuscript where different hands wrote different chapters of Florence's story. Some works celebrate military captains, others glorify poets, others honor saints. Some are allusions in fresco, others are sculptures carved in marble, others still are colors shining in glass. Together, they weave a fabric of art that speaks of Florence's pride, its faith, and its unending quest to surpass itself. Beneath the marble pavement where you stand lies another world. Hidden for centuries, it was rediscovered during archaeological excavations in the 1960s and 1970s. This is the crypt of Santa Reparata, the earlier cathedral of Florence, built long before the Duomo of Santa Maria del Fiore. To descend here is to walk through the memory of the city itself. The story begins in late antiquity. Archaeology has revealed traces of Roman houses beneath the present cathedral, their mosaic floors still visible in fragments. When Christianity spread in Florence, the community built its first great church on this site, dedicating it to Santa Reparata, a young martyr venerated in both East and West. According to tradition, Florence had prayed for her intercession during a battle against the Ostrogoths in the 5th century, and after victory, they honored her with a basilica. That early church was simple, with columns dividing its nave, and a mosaic floor decorated with geometric designs, animals, and Christian symbols. As centuries passed, the Basilica of Santa Reparata was enlarged, restored, and rebuilt. By the Carolingian era in the 8th and 9th centuries, it had become Florence's main cathedral. Here bishops presided, councils met, and citizens gathered for worship. Its pavements were laid in splendid colored mosaics, many of which you can still see today, interlaced knots, circles, and crosses, patterns both decorative and symbolic, reminding the faithful that the floor beneath them reflected the cosmic order of creation. In the Romanesque period, around the 11th century, the church was once more remodeled, giving it sturdier walls, new chapels, and a form more suited to the growing city. Yet by the late 1200s, Florence had outgrown Santa Reparata. The Republic dreamed of a cathedral that would eclipse those of rival cities like Pisa and Siena. So in 1296 they laid the foundation of Santa Maria del Fiore, the Saint Mary of the Flower, right next to and eventually over the old basilica. For decades the two churches coexisted, Santa Reparata serving as the city's cathedral while Santa Maria slowly rose beside it. Only when the Gothic giant was ready did Santa Reparata fall into ruin, eventually buried beneath the pavement of the new cathedral. Imagine walking down the stairs into the crypt. The light dims, the air cools, and you find yourself among ancient walls and pavements. You see the outline of the earlier basilica, its apse curving eastward, its nave traced by foundations. On the floor are the mosaic fragments, stylized birds, intricate braids, the zodiac signs that connected the rhythm of the heavens with the liturgy below. The space is a palimpsest, layers of history superimposed. Here Roman, Paleo-Christian, Carolingian, and Romanesque Florence all meet beneath the Gothic vaults of the Duomo. And here lies one of the most moving sights of all, the tomb of Filippo Brunelleschi. The city that once doubted him, that argued over his dome, that mocked his secrecy and eccentricity, chose to honor him at last by burying him inside the cathedral complex. His tombstone is simple, with a Latin inscription praising him as the inventor of the marvelous vault above. For centuries the exact location was forgotten, until rediscovered in the 20th century. Today visitors pause in reverence, for this is the resting place of the man whose genius gave Florence its defining silhouette. Nearby are other tombs as well, bishops of Florence, medieval clerics, figures of civic and religious life. The crypt was always a place of burial and memory. Each stone sarcophagus, each carved slab, reminds us that the cathedral is not only a house for the living but also a dwelling of the dead, a bridge between earth and heaven. Standing here in Santa Reparata, you sense continuity. The modern visitor descends past marble steps into a world where early Christians worshipped by candlelight, where medieval masons laid mosaic floors, where Brunelleschi himself was laid to rest. Above, the dome soars into the Renaissance. Below, the mosaics whisper of a simpler faith. Together, they tell the story of a city always renewing itself, always building on its own past, always reaching higher. When you return up the stairs to the nave of Santa Maria del Fiore, you emerge not just into space, but into time. You have traveled from Roman Florence to Renaissance Florence in a single descent and ascent. Few monuments in the world offer such a journey. The Duomo and its crypt are not separate buildings but one continuous narrative of faith and art, carved in stone and painted in color, stretching across a millennium. As you return from the crypt and stand again in the main body of the cathedral, your eyes are drawn naturally to the high altar. This is the liturgical heart of the Duomo, the place where the great feasts of Florence were celebrated, where bishops and later archbishops presided over solemn mass, where the city expressed its faith at the highest level. The altar is encircled by a marble choir enclosure, created in the 16th century by Baccia Bandinelli. Bandinelli was a sculptor of strong ambition, a rival of Michelangelo, and a favorite of the Medici Dukes. His marble balustrade and sculptural reliefs frame the altar with a sense of order and gravity, befitting the new era of Medici power in Florence. Here one sees how the cathedral evolved. The Gothic shell was Arnolfo's, the dome was Brunelleschi's, the frescoes were Vasari's and Zuccari's, and the liturgical furnishings were shaped under Medici rule. Above the altar, suspended from the dome, hangs a massive bronze crucifix designed by the sculptor and architect Benedetto Damiano. It reminds the faithful that the true center of all ceremony is not the Republic, not even the Medici, but the sacrifice of Christ. And yet the cathedral was always both sacred and civic. The altar was both a stage of faith and a theater of politics, where Florence showed itself to the world. Surrounding the choir are the two great organs of the cathedral. Their pipes gleam with silver light, and their sound fills the vast space with thunder. The earliest organ was installed in the 15th century. Later, larger instruments were added, and today the Duomo has one of the most powerful organs in Italy. Imagine the deep resonance of polyphonic motets in the 1400s, or the majestic roar of Baroque toccatas in the 1600s, shaking the very walls. For centuries, music was as much a part of the Duomo as stone or paint. It is impossible to speak of Florence's cathedral without speaking of the Medici family, for they shaped the city's destiny and left their mark here as well. The Medici rose from modest origins through the skill and ambition of Giovanni di Bicci de' Medici, who in the late 1300s and early 1400s transformed the family into bankers to kings and popes. Giovanni was not only a financier, he was also a patron. He contributed generously to the cathedral works, financing chapels and altars, and setting an example that his descendants would magnify. His son, Cosimo de' Medici, known as Cosimo the Elder, became the unofficial ruler of Florence. Though never holding official titles for long, Cosimo controlled the city through alliances, patronage, and his immense wealth. Cosimo saw the cathedral as a symbol of Florence's greatness and therefore of his own family's role in guiding the Republic. Under his influence, the Opera del Duomo, the institution that managed construction, received funds, and artists like Ghiberti and Brunelleschi found the backing they needed. It is no exaggeration to say that without Medici money and protection, Brunelleschi's dome might never have been finished. Cosimo also understood that patronage of sacred architecture was more than devotion, it was a way to write the Medici name into stone and history. Later members of the family continued this legacy. Lorenzo de' Medici, called the Magnificent, was baptized in the baptistry of San Giovanni like every Florentine, grew up in the shadow of the Duomo, and often sponsored ceremonies held here. Under the Medici Dukes in the 16th century, the cathedral's frescoes were completed by Vasari and Zuccari at their command, transforming the dome into a vision that proclaimed not only divine judgment but also the grandeur of Florence under Medici rule. The Medici also influenced the nearby buildings of the cathedral complex. It was Cosimo who supported Brunelleschi in building the old sacristy of San Lorenzo, another of Florence's great churches, and it was his descendants who would create the Grand Medici chapels as their dynastic mausoleum. Though the family's tombs are elsewhere, their presence in the Duomo is everywhere, in the choir enclosure Bandinelli carved at their order, in the fresco cycle Vasari painted at their command, in the very survival of the Opera del Duomo thanks to their patronage. The Medici story is thus entwined with the cathedral. The Duomo was begun by a republic eager to outshine its rivals, but it was completed and adorned under the watchful hand of Florence's first family. From Giovanni di Bicci's financial support to Cosimo's political backing, from Lorenzo's cultural magnificence to Cosimo I's ducal authority, the Medici ensured that Santa Maria del Fiore would not remain a half-finished shell but would become the crowned heart of Florence. And so, as you stand at the altar and choir, remember that you are also standing at the crossroads of faith and power. The stones around you were paid for by guilds of wool and silk, by offerings of citizens, but also by the deep coffers of the Medici Bank. The sculptures you see were carved by hands guided not only by devotion but also by commissions that bore the stamp of Medici approval. The frescoes above proclaim not only the last judgment of Christ but also the vision of a dynasty that saw itself as chosen to lead Florence. Yet for all their power, the Medici could not erase the Republic's memory. In the Duomo, you still see Hawkwood and Tolentino, mercenary captains honored by a free city. You see Dante, holding his Divine Comedy, painted decades after his exile as Florence claimed him again. You see Brunelleschi's tomb in the crypt, a man who rose from artisan obscurity to immortal glory through his own genius. The cathedral unites all these voices, guilds, families, poets, artists, bankers, citizens, saints. At the high altar, these voices converge in worship. At the choir, you hear them in song. In the dome, you see them in paint. And in the marble floor beneath your feet, you feel them in geometry. The Medici may have helped complete the work, but the cathedral belongs to all of Florence, a collective monument of a city that believed, above all, in the power of beauty to express truth. You have now journeyed through centuries inside and beneath Florence's cathedral, and as we come to the end of this story, let us pause and reflect on what it all means. It began outside, in the piazza, with the marble facade of Emilio de Fabris, a 19th-century homage to a medieval dream. It continued across the square at the Baptistry of San Giovanni, the octagonal cradle of every Florentine life, where even Dante received the waters of baptism, and where gilded bronze doors by Pisano and Ghiberti still glimmer like eternal sunlight. There you saw the golden mosaics of the Last Judgment, shimmering visions of heaven and hell that prepared every soul for entry into the Christian life. You then stepped inside the vast body of Santa Maria del Fiore, where the Gothic style of Arnolfo di Cambio and his successors stretches in solemn lines, austere yet immense, a space built not for private prayer alone but for an entire republic of citizens. You looked back to Uccello's medieval clock, a strange reminder that Florentines once measured their hours by sunset, and forward to the equestrian captains Hawkwood and Tolentino, painted monuments that turned flat walls into bronze illusions, symbols of Florence's civic pride. Light filtered through stained glass windows designed by Donatello, Ghiberti, Uccello, and Costagno, a kaleidoscope of prophets and saints, of Christ and the Virgin, glowing like sermons in color. On one wall you saw Dante, painted by Domenico di Michelino, presenting his Divine Comedy to a Florence that claimed him even in exile. Above the altar you saw Bandinelli's marble choir, Ghiberti's bronzes, Luca della Robbia's music, Donatello's dancing children, each generation leaving its mark, each generation adding to the cathedral's voice. And then you stood beneath the dome, Brunelleschi's impossible dream. You heard how he, a goldsmith turned architect, solved the unsolvable, raising a double shell of brick and stone without centering, inventing machines to lift the materials, designing a herringbone pattern of brick that locked the vault against collapse. You imagined the masons climbing higher and higher, brick by brick, until the lantern crowned the city like a second sun. You lifted your gaze to Vasari and Zuccari's vast fresco of the Last Judgment, a theater of salvation painted across more than 3,600 square meters, angels and demons spiraling upward and downward, Christ enthroned in the center as judge of all. From there you descended into the crypt, into Santa Reparata, Florence's forgotten cathedral. You walked among the mosaics of the early Christians, saw the outlines of the Carolingian and Romanesque churches, and finally paused before Brunelleschi's tomb, the man who gave Florence its emblem resting humbly beneath the work that defined him. And as you emerged again into the nave, you remembered the Medici, the family that transformed Florence from republic to duchy. Giovanni di Bicci, who laid the financial foundations, Cosimo the Elder, who funded architects and artists, Lorenzo the Magnificent, who raised Florence to cultural heights, and Cosimo I, who commanded Vasari to paint the dome with visions of eternity. The Medici left their mark here as patrons, as rulers, as visionaries, ensuring that the cathedral would not remain a skeleton but would rise and shine as the symbol of Florence forever. What, then, is Santa Maria del Fiore? It is not only a church. It is a palimpsest of Florence itself, a book written in stone, glass, paint, and marble. It is the voice of guilds who paid for its chapels, the hand of Brunelleschi who engineered its dome, the brush of Vasari who painted its heavens, the prayer of generations baptized in the baptistry, the echo of Dante's verses, the pride of the Medici who claimed it as their own, the sweat of masons, the song of choirs, the faith of countless pilgrims. Every visitor who steps into this space joins that story. You stand where Florentines stood in times of plague and triumph, where armies were blessed before battle, where processions carried relics through the nave, where the bells tolled for victory, mourning, or celebration. You look up at the same dome that Galileo, Michelangelo, and Leonardo once looked at, each in their time amazed by Brunelleschi's genius. You hear the same silence that once held polyphonic motets, or the thundering organ, or the voice of Savonarola preaching fire and repentance. The cathedral is, above all, Florence's memory. From the baptistry mosaics to the dome frescoes, from Santa Reparata's mosaics to Brunelleschi's lantern, it unites a thousand years of history into one experience. It whispers that time is fleeting, like Uccello's sunset clock. It shouts that human genius can rival the ancients, like Brunelleschi's dome. It sings that beauty leads to truth, like Donatello's windows or Dante's verses. It warns that every soul will one day be judged, like Vasari's fresco, and it promises that faith, art, and community together can build something greater than any individual. When you leave the Duomo, pause one last time in the piazza. Look again at the marble facade, the campanile, the baptistry, and the dome. Notice how they speak to each other, octagon to square, tower to dome, gold mosaic to painted fresco, early Christian faith to Renaissance invention. Notice how they rise above the crowd of modern life, still commanding the city as they did 600 years ago. And carry with you the realization that Florence is not only the city of art and beauty, but also the city that believed enough in itself to attempt the impossible and succeeded. This is the story of Santa Maria del Fiore. This is the story of Florence. And now it is also your story, for you have walked through it, seen it, and heard it. Wherever you go, may the memory of Brunelleschi's dome, the golden mosaics of the baptistry, the voices of the artists, and the faith of a city stay with you, like an eternal light glowing in your heart. Thank you for joining us on this journey through the baptistry of San Giovanni, the Cathedral of Santa Maria del Fiore, Brunelleschi's dome, the frescoes of Vasari and Zuccari, the crypt of Santa Reparata, and the legacy of Florence's greatest artists and families. This has been more than a visit, it has been a walk through a thousand years of history, faith, and genius. From the golden mosaics of the baptistry to the soaring dome above, from Dante's verses to Brunelleschi's invention, you have experienced the soul of Florence. On behalf of EU Tours, we wish you an experience of a lifetime. May the beauty of this city remain with you long after you leave its streets, and may the memory of Florence's Duomo inspire you always to look upward, to imagine, and to believe in the impossible. All the sources for this audio content have been taken with the liberty of UNESCO Archives, the Vatican Resources, and the Alexandrian Cultural Collections. Grazie, thank you, and arrivederci from EU Tours.